I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Front Backpage, my name is Martin Gregg and welcome to a new episode of Between the Lines, the stories behind great sports writing. This is my conversation with Oliver Kaye about his fantastic book Forever Young, the story of Adrian Doherty, football's lost genius. I think this is the longest episode we've ever produced, but I just felt there was so much stuff to cover with Ollie that I really wanted to do the book justice. If you've read the book, then I think you'll really, really enjoy this. And if you haven't read it, then I hope it encourages you to pick it up. Enjoy. So, Ollie, I want to take you back to when you first heard about the story of Adrian Doherty. I believe you were researching an article for Giggs's 20th anniversary, is that right?
Yeah, which gives you some idea of how long ago it was, or how long there was between stumbling upon the idea and publication. Because, that was early 2011, which, as you said, was Ryan Giggs's... You know, it's come out to 20 years since Ryan Giggs's debut for Manchester United. The book came out in mid 2016, so nearly 5.5 years later. And what happened basically was, you know, I was speaking to ex-youth teammates of Ryan Giggs, not the kind of class of 92 that he's always associated with, but those who were playing alongside him when he was a 16-year-old in the youth team in 1990-91. So I was speaking to people like Mark Bosnich, who obviously went on to play for Villa and United and Chelsea, guys like Alan Tong, who didn't make it in terms of Man United, but had a good, lower league career. And I was saying to them, at 16, was he just head and shoulders above everybody else? And they both really said the same thing. They both said, well, there was this guy, Adrian Doherty, are you aware of him? And I was loosely aware of the name because I've got that kind of weird, anally retentive memory. It was, I didn't know anything about what had happened to him or how good he'd been or the story. And, I think Alan was who said to me, well, the doc was as good as Giggsy at 16, if not better. He was completely off the wall character. He was, played guitar and, worshipped Bob Dylan. Then he did his knee injury, didn't recover, retired from football, and nothing was heard of him again until sadly he died. What would it be, nearly 10 years later at the age of 26. And from that moment, really, I was just thinking, oh my God, that just sounds like the most incredible story. Why has nobody told that story before? Why do I not know it? I Googled it and there was almost nothing on the entire internet at the time in 2011, apart from a sort of online tribute to him by one of his former coaches in Ireland who had said, who basically had these two newspaper clippings, one from 1990 saying that he was on the verge of his Manchester United debut as a 16-year-old, saying that he was being tipped to make an impact not seen since George Best. And the next was 10 years later saying sadly he died in Holland. And I just was immediately utterly captivated by this and thought, I need to know more about this. I need to start doing some serious digging because as interesting as Ryan Giggs's 20th anniversary was, this suddenly set me off on a completely different journey.
That moment when you discover that this is a story that's largely undocumented, that must be the point when the pulse starts racing, when you as a writer discover that you have this like virgin territory almost to explore, but I think we'll go on to this in a bit more, but for me the key to the book is this, the discovery not just of the scale of the talent but almost like the depth of the character. When you start to realise how a unique individual this is, then is that the moment? Is it when you put these kind of two pieces together of the talent and the character, do you start to think at that point, this is a book?
Yeah, because I went over to Strabane in County Tyrone to meet his family and they said, well, look, we'd love to meet you and, for you to come over and we can talk to you about Adrian, but we don't think we want to do a newspaper article, and or we don't you know, they didn't want to do a book or a newspaper article or whatever. And I thought, well, you know what, I'll go over there and I'll sweet talk them into it. And so I did go over, and I, you know, this was very much with a view to, you know, writing a newspaper article in the Times, where I was at the time. As I was there with them that day, and you know, I spent hours with them, and they were talking about his personality. So I'd gone there with sort of a preconception of this being a story about you know, an extreme talent that you've never heard of that didn't make it. And then I was there, and they were telling me all this stuff about his various escapades and going busking in the city centre, and you know, getting ridiculed by his teammates for wearing, you know, secondhand clothes, you know, buying his clothes from a charity shop rather than from well, it was probably Top Man at the time where the others bought their clothes. But you know, going busking and in the city centre, and this, you know, writing his own songs, and they produced this sort of folder full of poems and songs that he'd written. And I'm just thinking, oh my god, this is incredible. You know, I'm you know, shivers going down my spine. And then they're telling me about him going off to America, you know, almost at the drop of a hat. One season had finished, and he had an injured knee at the time, and he just decided, spur of the moment, really, to go to America and go to New York and try and, you know, get signed up as a, you know, as a Manchester United footballer, trying to get a record deal, playing in Greenwich Village and all this kind of thing. And I'm just thinking, this is unbelievable, all of this. This is, you know, if they do agree to me doing a newspaper article about him, I'm going to struggle to get this into 1,500 words in the Times. I might get up to 1,600, but it's going to be very hard to tell this story. You know, I left there that day and thinking I have to persuade them ultimately to do something, because this would be a fascinating book. The story certainly fascinated me and captivated me so much that I felt desperate to write that book, and I really had to wait until they were ready to do it. But you know, that just set me off on a journey where I was just sort of ringing anybody I could think of, really, to try and get an insight on this guy.
Did you ever write that article for the Times, or did you keep your powder dry and just say, you know, that this needs a bigger palette, and kind of holding off to try and persuade the family to do the book?
Probably on the flight home that day, you know, flight home from Belfast, I was writing something with a view to trying to persuade them that look, you know, we could do this article. But no, it never saw the light of day, because they didn't want to do a newspaper article. Their view was that, you know, you could do a newspaper article and it would be, you know, here today, gone tomorrow type thing. You know, although it would live on online, I think their view was the correct one, really. And, you know, at that point, they didn't want to write they didn't want a book either. But I think over time, they decided that maybe another year or two went by and, you know, Adrian's memory was perhaps being sort of feeling more and more distant in terms, not for them, but for everybody else, and people in Strabane and people in Manchester and so on. And I think they got to the point where they just thought, well, let's go with this idea. You know, maybe it would be the best way in terms of preserving his memory and letting his story be known by a lot more people.
So did you just keep in touch with the family then and just say, look, this is a story that I would like to tell in book form, and when you're ready, get in touch? Or, like, you know, how did it make the leap from...
I played the long game, really, with them. And, yeah. I got on very well with them. They're lovely people. And you know, Jimmy, Adrian's father, you know, introduced me to a lot of people who were keen to share their memories of him as well, even though at that time it was feeling like a kind of recreational pursuit that might never see the light of day. I was always quite confident that ultimately they would come around to the idea of either an article or a book. And my day job is as a journalist, and had they been willing to do a newspaper article, that's what would have appeared first. But they didn't want to do a newspaper article. I think they realised there'd be something a bit more sort of pure and more enduring in terms of doing a book. And I'm really glad that they did. It's the best, professionally, it's the best, you know, the best and most important thing I've done, the thing I'm proudest of, really.
How long was the long game? I mean, between that first meeting with the family and then deciding to write a book, and then, you know, the book being commissioned, like, how long was it?
2 years or two and a bit years, maybe, between meeting them and then coming around to the idea. And then I think, you know, part of the problem, I mean, I did some work on it in the summer of 2013. A couple of weeks off I had that summer, and I worked on you know, spoke to a few people then with a view to getting this book out. But you know, this, so I then spoke to a publisher, and they said, well, could you produce something in the summer of 2014? And I said, well, there's absolutely no chance, really, because there was the World Cup, and you know, I was going to be away for 7 weeks there and then, and I needed to sort of create a slot far into the future, really, where I would deliver it in late 2015 or early 2016. And I needed a whole kind of quiet summer, really, working on it, which was the summer of 2015. So it was a very long process. You know, just the number of people I needed to speak to for it. I think I did something like 100 interviews for it, and speaking to not just people he knew through football, but people growing up in Strabane and people he then met in Preston in his various guitar groups and working in a factory with them, and then people he met in Galway, and a lot of whom didn't know the slightest thing about his sort of backstory. So it felt like a really big undertaking, really.
I want to talk a bit about the research in a minute, but I'd like to kind of start at the start. And there's this kind of wonderful opening scene, which is match day at Old Trafford, and you know, the fans are all pouring towards the stadium, and you know, you portray this small figure shuffling in the opposite direction towards Manchester City Centre. And just to quote from the book, you say, "As inconspicuous as he might look, pale, slight, scruffy, dressed in what looked suspiciously like second-hand clothes, the busker is not a complete unknown. Far from it, in fact. Adrian Doherty is a Manchester United footballer of outstanding promise." Now, it's just a wonderful scene because you have, you know, this sea of humanity flowing towards Old Trafford, and then this guy heading in the other direction when, you know, you'd far more expect him to be there and taking in the first team game. Was that always going to be your way into the book? Did you have to think long and hard about that, or was that a kind of obvious way to start it, where you set up this fascinating contrast between the obsessives and the guy who should be an obsessive but is actually obsessing about something else, you know, his music and his other life?
I don't want to really kind of sound like I'm talking up the talking up the creative process, but it came to me one night when I think we were watching TV in bed, and I was probably had half an eye on it, and I was thinking about this, and I always wanted to do that you know, that scene of him busking being the opening sort of the introduction to the character, you know, the footballer who busked. And one of his teammates had said this thing about him sort of hanging around outside the stadium with his tickets and giving them away and going off with his guitar, getting on the bus, and I suddenly just thought, that is the way in. That's the way in. And they talked about him singing "Like a Rolling Stone," and that was one of his, you know, one of many Dylan songs he sang, and that seemed to fit beautifully because it's the kind of, you know, it's about like a kind of, you know, a fall from grace. It's about sort of somebody who goes from having everything to being a sort of misfit in society and kind of relishing that sort of underdog hobo kind of status, so it felt like everything kind of fell into place with that. So that was how I, so it starts with him being outside the stadium and then him giving his tickets away and getting on the bus just as all the fans are getting off it, and then going into city centre and busking. And as I was writing it, it felt like a sort of screenplay type thing, and I was hoping somebody would one day do that, but they haven't done. There was a few expressions of interest, but it seemed to, everything sort of fits together very nicely in terms of that.
It's a very visual opening, you're right about that, and you could almost see it working in film format. I mean, you're obviously interested in the idea of lost talents. Now, you know, I read an article, an interview with Michael Johnson that you did quite recently, and there was the Arsenal guys at Paul Vassen, really interesting stories, but very different to Doherty's in the sense of this is just a great story about an interesting life. And I think that's what that opening does. It sets it up for, I mean, I can imagine someone who's not actually interested in football reading this, because it's just the story of a very interesting human life. And I guess that's what you're doing when you set out your stall in that way, in that opening scene, that it just says, here's an interesting person, you're going to enjoy this journey.
For example, my My mother-in-law, who's certainly not interested in football, so she read it and enjoyed it and often yeah. tells me so, you know, about how she thought she would have no interest in, and she sort of ended up feeling very sort of besotted with and protective of this character that you know, I think a very sort of warm, sympathetic character, really. I think a lot of people who, I've had a lot of people who don't have an interest in football who have enjoyed it. I don't think it's there's probably a lot in there for the football obsessive and the Manchester United obsessive, but I think there's probably enough of life outside and music as well, and that it's more about the character and the person that Adrian was.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I first read it, actually, I think I was really interested in the football side of it, because I'm really interested in these type of stories as well. But I think rereading it again recently for this interview, I think, you know, in the intervening years, I've become a parent. And you actually, you kind of see it from a parental point of view. Towards the end, I could really feel his family's pain. It's interesting you talk about your mother-in-law. She's kind of... she had these emotions towards this character, so there's so much in it for different people, I guess.
On top of that, I think, I mean, it sort of covers three really interesting sort of times and places. I mean, in that you've got Strabane, which is, you know, on the Irish border, you know, during the Troubles, sort of in the 70s, when he was born in 1973, and grew up with I'm not saying bombs going off every day or anything like that. It wasn't every day, but there was, you know, but Strabane and Derry were focal points of the Troubles, and you know, there were soldiers patrolling the streets often and you know, checking out people's houses and searching people's houses, you know. So grew up in that time, and then he went to Manchester, and it's sort of late 80s, early 90s, although, I mean, it wasn't his scene, the Hacienda and all that, but he's sort of part of that, not just that time in Manchester, but that time at Manchester United, where there was just that sort of huge, you know, dawn of an empire under Sir Alex Ferguson, as he was then. And then ends up in, you know, even if I skip Preston, you know, ends up in Galway at a time when, you know, a lot of people were, you know, from all over Europe were being attracted to Ireland, you know, with freedom of movement and the Celtic Tiger kind of boom. And, you know, he was friends with a lot of people from, you know, German friends and French friends who had, lots of different people who had gravitated towards that art scene in Galway, like the same as he had. And it's also, yeah, apart from the character and the football career he had, I think just those three periods are three really interesting time, you know, snapshots of the British Isles over that period. And I've said to people a few times, really, that if you were wanting to write a novel about a sort of a footballer and you wanted to sort of set him in the real world, I think you would probably, you know, if you were going to set him in the distant past, you would probably think, well, okay, let's make him a bit different, and let's put him in Manchester United's sort of class of, I mean, not the class of 92, but let's put him alongside Ryan Giggs and Paul Scholes and Gary Neville and David Beckham, and let's put him in that environment with Sir Alex Ferguson, the manager who loved his talent but didn't really understand him as a guy. Let's make him Irish like George Best. Let's make him a guitar playing poetry writing. You know, it's there were times when uncovering his story, and I just felt this is kind of almost too good to be true, because it's the character is so kind of perfectly different to everybody else. And a few people have said to me, oh, there must be thousands of stories like this. And I think, well, in terms of somebody who was like absolutely extreme talent, you know, Ryan Giggs saying that, he was as good as me, he was better than me at 16. You know, Gary Neville saying the same, all the reports from the Times say that. And in terms of being an extreme personality and being the opposite of that kind of Ryan Giggs, Gary Neville type football obsessive archetype, it's, I think that, you know, that I think, you know, and being into music and Bob Dylan and theological things, philosophical things as well, rather than being into, you know, fast cars and chasing women and et cetera. It's just such a... It felt like it was almost perfect in terms of his personality. But the element that isn't perfect is that his career and his life just, you know, didn't follow the path everybody would have hoped.
So let's focus on the talent alone for a while. And the second section of the book is kind of the ultimate testimony to his talent, because it's quite an extended section with Ryan Giggs. And talking about Doherty, and I'll quote from the book here. He said, "I had never seen anything like him before. He was the quickest I'd ever seen, and he was so brave as well. He was a freak. He was incredible. He was definitely at the same level as me. He was definitely on the brink of making his first team debut. He definitely had the talent. My guess is that, mentality-wise, it would have been no problem for him." So it's really interesting because, you know, this idea of, you know, the lost talent theme, it's almost like a subgenre of sports writing in a way. But I think for me, you know, the bar has to be high to give that story real authenticity. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the hinterland that Doherty has, and I think that's really, really important, right? But I think the scale of the talent is really important as well. Now, just to pick up on something you said here, because it's really interesting that I was going through the article that you wrote a couple of weeks ago, actually, for the Athletic on Doherty, and I was reading through the comment section, and this is a comment somebody's written. It says, "It does make you wonder, though, how many Adrian Dohertys are out there, potentially thousands of players who could have been the next big thing, but disappear into obscurity." And I just disagree with that so much, because this guy wasn't the best player in your school. He wasn't the best player in your district. He wasn't even the best player in the country. This was a generational talent. And the testimonies from guys who were generational talents themselves bear that out. And I think, I don't know if you saw that as almost like a hurdle that you had to go over. That's not who he was. He wasn't one of those thousands of guys, you know, that we played with and, you know, we all played with and were really good players, but that, you know, liked a pint. This guy was Ryan Giggs, that it was generational. So I guess my question is, you know, by putting Giggs at the front as well and putting this glowing testimony, were you trying to go over that hurdle for people to say, no, this guy was an exception?
Yeah, I think so. I spoke to Ryan Giggs fairly late in the process. There was a point where I can't remember who else I was going to introduce at that point, that sort of second section of that second section of the introduction. But I spoke to Giggs fairly late on, and I wasn't confident that I would persuade him to talk about Adrian, because he'd never done so before. But it was, so I think to have those names talking in those terms about him was really important. And you know, I did a piece recently about Michael Johnson, who was at Manchester City, and I wrote that for The Athletic, and I interviewed him, and look, he was a real top talent in terms of, you know, broke into the Premier League at 18, and everybody was saying, well, this guy's going to play for England, and Didier Mann was saying, you know, he was as good as Steven Gerrard at the same age, which, you know, this is really high praise. And it's, I think possibly with Manchester United, there are so many players who everybody talks about outside of the ones who did make it. So you've got Ben Thornley, who was a really, really good talent and played a few games for United's first team, and then did his cruciate as well, and ended up having a decent career, but not anything like the career he would have done before. You know, there's people like Lee Sharp, who had, you know, a really, really good career, played for England and played, you know, won the Premier League, but didn't have the career that he potentially would have done. There's a guy I spoke to for the book, Giuliano Majorana, who was a little bit older than Adrian, but he had a handful of games and looked really, really good. I remember him growing up, and he did his knee as well. The thing that was with Adrian was that not only was he like regarded as good a raw talent as Giggs, and was regarded equivalent to Giggs at 16, 17, but that sort of 20 years on, nobody had heard of him. Like his story had been completely forgotten. And to use an example, I tried to do, when the book was coming out, the publisher said, we've noticed there's no Wikipedia page for him. Could we do a Wikipedia page for him. Do you know how to do it? And I said, no, I don't, but I'll try and do it. And so I tried to set up a Wikipedia page, and I got an email or message straight back from Wikipedia saying, no, this person does not meet our criteria for a notable person, because he never played a full match in a professional league, which is a fully professional league, which is true. So because he never played for Manchester United at all, he'd never really got mentioned apart from by a handful of Manchester United youth team obsessives on message boards saying, does anybody remember Adrian Doherty? So not only are you talking about an extreme talent at 16, 17, who was, let's say, one of the best in his top three in his age group in Britain at the time. I think you could really very, very safely say that. I think some people say he would have been, the top one or equal top with Giggs at the time. You go from that to basically leaving no footprint whatsoever in professional football and being completely forgotten, really, until the book came out. And it's I think that is an extreme drift into obscurity, and it's not, it's not that, I think every club, every Premier League club, you speak to them about players who've come through their academy, they'll say, they might pick out a player every 5 years who they think, well, that one was going to be a first team player and didn't make it because of injury or because of attitude or bad luck or whatever. But this is a player who technically was good enough to be anything he wanted to be and ended up not making any impact whatsoever on professional football.
I think that the tragedy and the drama comes from that sort of sliding doors effect. For anyone who's listening that's not read the book, Doherty's earmarked to make his debut against Everton, and then the week before he wrecks his knee against Carlisle, and the Carlisle reserves, I think it is, he's playing a reserve match. So it's not like 12 months hence he might have been given 10 minutes as a substitute. This guy moves right on the brink. I mean, he's 7 days, which I guess that adds to the drama and the sense of tragedy as well, doesn't it, that he's so close?
Yeah, you've reminded me actually that before I'd really kind of uncovered the whole thing of his character, that the sort of sliding doors element with Ryan Giggs was what I thought was probably the best sort of peg for for it, and I ended up sort of finding out so much about his character that I thought, well, it's almost like a secondary element, that I don't want it to be this guy could have been Ryan Giggs, because the reality is that he was totally different as a character to Ryan Giggs. And perhaps even if the situations had been reversed, if Giggs had got injured that week, I think Giggs would have insisted on playing on at whatever level. Even if they'd made a terrible mess of his knee, I think he would have been playing for Salford City or playing. He would have been desperate to make absolutely anything of his career. And I think Adrian was desperate initially to get back from the injury, but then just sort of fell into found a different way of life and embraced that way of life that was completely different. And I think even if he had made his debut this is one thing I always want to kind of steer people away from, when people say, oh, so he could have had another career like Ryan Giggs, I will say, well, I don't think he would have done, because I think he would have played the first team. He might have made an even greater impact at first team level than Ryan Giggs, but I think the spotlight, the scrutiny, the hype, the money, the attention, I just think he would have hated it. The demands in terms of training each, not having any fun really, just your life revolving around football, I think he would have struggled with all of that. So I prefer to think that if he had made his debut and at 17, and he would have had a fantastic impact for maybe a year or two, maybe 5 years, maybe 6 months, 6 weeks, who knows? But that sooner or later he'd have thought, I can do without this. I want to just do my own thing. I do think he would have found, I do think he would have made that decision sooner or later. And that's that is one of many reasons why I like to steer people away from the idea that this is just another sort of lost talent story. I think it's different to that.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There is a point about whether someone has the mentality to play top flight football at all and thrive in that setting for, you know, whatever period. And, you know, again, that's the thing. Going back to the lost talent, I think that's where a lot of these stories fall down. When people acknowledge those who have the talent, but then they don't acknowledge that they don't have the character or the mentality to do it. Because if you don't have both, then you don't have anything. You know, the talent without the mentality is nothing in terms of playing at the very, very top level. But I think this is the real complexity of the story, because, you know, Doherty's ambivalence is really towards the aspects around the sports. For me, anyway, it was to do with the culture that he was involved in, you know, the dressing room culture, all that sort of stuff. But he didn't have a lack of passion or commitment towards the actual sport. I mean, he didn't not turn up for training. You know, there's a great part where he talks about his kind of self-improvement, and he used to go up the park and dribble around bottles constantly to improve himself on both feet. I think he declares at 15 that he wants to be the best player in the world at 21. So, you know, he loves football in its purest form, but it just wasn't the only thing in his life. Everybody who lines up, all these greats who line up to talk about his talent, also talk about his mentality, and they say, no, we do believe that this guy could have played, you know, at the very top level. Whether he could have sustained it, like, the point you're making is different, but it seems to me that he did have that mentality that he could have played in front of 60,000 people at Old Trafford.
I mean, that's the point that everybody, I mean, almost ahead of his talent, people say, yeah, he was incredibly brave, so courageous, would never be daunted by anything, whether it was, you know, opposition fullbacks from Carlisle reserves or wherever kicking him, or whether it was, you know, a crowd or an occasion or the attention being on him, or, you know, almost like the bigger the stage when he was growing up and playing in Ireland, he felt, you know, he thrived more the more eyes were on him. There was a game where he played for, you know, in front of a full crowd at the Brandywell in Derry before a pre-season friendly, and you know, that was, you know, he just relished that, and a lot of his sort of most celebrated performances in the youth team were at Old Trafford, so he seemed to just relish that, you know, that big stage in a way that people found surprising, because he seemed so shy off the pitch. And yeah, everybody, I think without exception, says that if he had played for the first team, he would have just, you know, he would have coped. No, you know, in terms of that 90-minute challenge, you know, a debut against Everton or whatever, or play, you know, Giggs' second appearance was against Manchester City in a Manchester derby, and he, well, he was credited with the goal, but it was Colin Hendry's own goal, really. But it was, but you know, everybody said about Giggs that he didn't, you know, he was fearless, and it's the same. People said it even more about Adrian, both at the time and subsequently, that he was fearless. He would have no difficulty whatsoever turning that talent into producing on a big stage. He wouldn't fear anything. So on that level, yeah, he had absolutely the mentality. He was courageous and brave, and would block out everything else when he was playing. But I think it was the probably the other hours in a day or in a week where you would say, well, does he have the sort of classic footballer mentality to want to sort of commit every moment of his life to trying to stay at the top? And look, that kind of thing is exaggerated, because even somebody as great as Roy Keane, who, as dedicated as Roy Keane, he was out drinking all the time in the 90s anyway. And it was, you know, so we talk about, you know, ultra professional, etc. It's a slightly different thing. But Adrian, I think, just had so much else in his life and was so, as you said, ambivalent about elements of the football industry and the footballer, about professional football, really. And that's why I've never been convinced that he would have had a Ryan Giggs type career. And also, I think there's probably something slightly romantic in the idea that if he had made it, if he'd been Young Player of the Year in 1992 and a Premier League title winner in 93, that he might just have gone off into the sunset in 1994 and gone off and picked up a guitar and sat in a pub in Galway or whatever. I think there's something tantalising in that image, but I do think that's kind of the way he would have gone.
There's always something that really elevated the book for me when I first read it, that it was, and something that I think people have to bear in mind is like that it was injury. It wasn't apathy and it wasn't fear that stopped this guy. You know, it was a really, really, really cruel injury. And you can't bundle up the other parts of his life into an explanation of apathy, because he did it. He was there. He was on the verge. And everyone says he would have carried it on.
Somebody like Gary Neville, who would be... I don't think Gary Neville would talk up the mentality of a player who didn't make it and talk up the mentality of a player who didn't make it and was more interested in music. and so I think the feeling that it was sort of, despite this multi-layered character that was sort of ambivalent about elements of the football industry and the sort of professional footballer lifestyle, I think, yeah. I mean, he, despite all of that, despite Ferguson's kind of lack of comprehension at him sort of disappearing to go busking on a Saturday afternoon rather than watching the first team, despite, look, you know, being scruffy or turning up without laces in his shoes or his kit in his plastic bag or not have a tie or whatever, despite all of those things, Ferguson was ready to give him his first team debut because he thought he was ready at 17. Not because, I mean, look, there was an injury crisis, but he was relishing the prospect of giving him his debut at 17. I think he became apathetic towards football after the injury. I think once he got injured and felt, look, I'm not going to get back to the player I was going to be. Do I really want to get back to being, you know, a shadow of the player I was going to be? I think his focus drifted after that. And also, I would say his focus wasn't the conventional footballer focus. I think he was just an incredible raw talent with an incredible mentality when he was on the pitch, who, when he was off the pitch, probably wasn't thinking about football. So it's, but you do hear of players like that. But I think he would have taken it to an extreme.
Yeah, you talk a little bit about these, you know, how undocumented the story was, and you know, there's a section towards the end of the book where you talk about Manchester United's relationship with this story and how they've really struggled to come to terms with it. And I mean, you mentioned Giggs, obviously. We've mentioned the Nevilles, or Gary Neville, and you spoke to Phil Neville as well. When you approached these guys, like, how ready or and able were they to talk about Rodocity? Did they relish it, or did they take a bit of persuading to go back there?
There had been a dispute between Manchester United and Adrian's father about the handling of the injury, about the handling of his time there. I think some of the players, well, I know some of the players were aware of that sort of history. You know, with those players who were sort of very integral to the Manchester United family, if you like, you know, the Neville brothers and Ryan Giggs and obviously Sir Alex Ferguson himself, I was very, very tentative in terms of approaching him. I wanted to leave them until last, just because, you know, and I thought, well, I'm not sure these guys will, you know, that there must be a reason why none of them have spoken about him before. That, and I messaged Phil Neville, and he said, yeah, of course. And I had a really good conversation with Phil Neville, and I messaged Gary Neville, and he said, yeah, of course, call me on this day. You know, Ryan Giggs the same. I mean, the three of them spoke so openly and effusively and enthusiastically about him, and that, Yeah, it was, with real fondness and admiration and Giggs especially, Giggs has spoken about him and I think with Robbie Savage did a podcast recently where he asked whether he spoke about him, and Giggs speaks about him almost with a, he sounds very emotional when he speaks about him, but also sounds really kind of awestruck when he talks about how good this guy was, and he was quicker than me, he was braver than me, he was more consistent than me, and you think, God, that's quite quick, brave and consistent then.
Yeah, at Real Tonker asks, Rye, was the Doc, Adrian Doherty, a better player than him at YTS level? Listen, I shared the digs with the Doc, sadly, no longer with us, but a player Ryan the Doc was.
No, he was better than me. He was better than everyone. He was, you would watch the game and you'd watch him go past and you would wonder, how has he done it? He was just so quick, so brave, and everything just went, his brain as well was working quicker. He was an amazing talent. I mean, yeah. Eric used to kill me, really, because he was rapid as well. We used to do the little doggies, the little shuttle runs. He used to always pair me with a Doc, and he was rapid. So, and then he would be shouting, come on, he's beating you, Ryan, he's beating you. You know what he was like. And but he was an amazing talent. What a talent. And he had a horrific, obviously, knee injury, which curtailed his career. But what a talent at 16.
And then with Sir Alex Ferguson as well, he I wrote to him, and he wrote back with lovely sentiments about Adrian, and I was really, really pleased by that, not just because it was a nice thing to put on the front, quotes about them quotes from those guys on the front of the book, but because I think it was important really for Adrian's family to know that on a personal level, whatever the kind of corporate dispute there had been between the family and the club, that there was a real admiration and sense of fondness and appreciation on a personal level.
I want to start to wrap things up by talking about research. When we published our first book about 10 years ago now, actually, the author, James Morgan, the book was called In Search of Alan Goseen. A Northern Irish guy, James Morgan, wrote it, and he delved into the research to such an extent, off the scale, the amount of research he did. I think it made for a more enduring book. I think the book has stood the test of time, and I reread it recently, and I thought, there's so much in that that his research really bore fruit. And I haven't had that feeling again until I read this book. It is so densely researched, and I think you say, I don't know if it's in the introduction, you talk about your obsession began, you use the word obsession, and I thought, I believe that, because I was going through it, I was writing them down, former landladies, teammates, coaches, musicians that you played with in New York, the Troubadour Club in Manchester, you travelled to Galway, you tracked down a guy called Paleface, who's an American singer-songwriter, part of the East Village in 1990. You go to a biscuit factory in Preston, where he once worked. You actually put out a call on Radio Lancashire for anyone who knew him during this period. I mean, this must have been the research expedition to end all research trips. Take us inside that process. That must have been exhaustive.
I mean, as a journalist, I mean, that's what you do as a journalist. You kind of try to get every detail on a story, but the difference with Adrian is that there was basically nothing out there. So I started with the conversations that I mentioned with Alan Tong and Mark Bosnich and Eric Harrison, the late Eric Harrison, who coached him at youth level at Manchester United. And then I needed to track down his parents, and so was looking online, and then realised that nearly everybody in that part of Ireland is called Doherty, and that this wasn't going to be easy. So I went through the local parish priest there, who was also called, yes, Doherty, and he put me in touch with the family, and so then I went to the family. They gave me the list, various friends of Adrian's to speak to. But beyond that, because he's, he'd been at home for 16 years. He'd then been in Manchester as a player for 4 years. So that those 4 years in Manchester were not the most difficult to research for a football journalist, and who's good contacts at Man United and stuff like that. So I spoke to loads of his teammates and people he was in digs with, and people that, you know, people like Robbie Savage and Keith Gillespie, that, and the Neville brothers and Ryan Giggs, that people will have heard of, and loads of people that didn't make it. I think those guys often had the more vivid memories, because those years were what they really cling on to in terms of their memories of their football careers. So they had much more vivid memories of A-team games and reserve games and life in digs, etc. And then I had the task of trying to uncover his life in Preston, where he was for 4 years, and in Galway for 3 years, I think it was. And that was, you know, I was really starting with a bit of a blank canvas there, because I was, you know, in terms of Galway, I had basically the name and number of one of his friends, and then that friend said, well, look, I'm not in touch with many of those guys anymore, but there was a guy called this, there was a guy called that, and I'm sort of looking up on, you know, Googling all these names, and I think the, you know, the nature of Irish names, where there's a lot of very common names, made it harder to track some people down. But, you know, eventually, you know, one door would open another, and you know, one person would put me in touch with another person, or at least give me a name, and I would then look them up. And I can be a bit like a dog with a bone with that kind of thing. So in terms of you know, speaking to all the right people, yeah, it was. I mean, part of it was I was just so fascinated by Adrian's story that it was just a lot of fun, and I really enjoyed it. And every conversation I had with somebody who knew him would say, "Oh, I didn't know him that well. I might not be able to help you," but, and then they'd be, you know, it would just sort of trigger things off for them. Most of those conversations were an hour plus, and there was, you know, there were, you know, well over 100 of them, and then it would be transcribing them and and so on, which was onerous. And, you know, and then there was the issue of trying to familiarise myself more with, you know, the troubles and growing up, you know, what it was like growing up in Strabane, and speaking to a lot of his friends about that and his family about that, and reading up on the history of the time. And I mean, it's a fascinating period in history, dark period in history, but a fascinating one. And, you know, his dad was there in Derry on Bloody Sunday, and you know, that kind of, it was very interesting. There was nothing where I was researching it and thinking, God, this is a bit dull. Do I have to find out more about him doing this? You know, even his time working in a chocolate factory was fascinating to me, because there was that sense that he didn't really want to tell his colleagues about it. He wasn't really interested in telling his colleagues who he was and where he'd been before in his life. He was just very vague about his past life, and they knew him as Aidan, and I would assume that's because he just didn't want anybody to recognise his name as Adrian Doughty, the ex-Manchester United footballer, as he was by that stage.
I mean, I guess it's a passion for the subject that drives you to such lengths. I mean, I guess the point I was making before is, like, you don't have to go to that, you know, that biscuit factory. You know, there's a line that you can stop and say, I've got enough about this guy. But I think because he's such a multi-layered personality, and because, I guess, when you get to that point in your research, right, it must be like panning for gold. Because you're not going to, I guess you're probably not going to find any big revelations, but you're going to get little shards of insight. So if you know, so in that sense, that trip is worth taking. You know, you go to that factory because somebody will just give you a little morsel that you can drop in. And I guess that's the beauty of books. You can drop it in. Athletic piece is never going to stretch to that sort of lens, but, you know, a book will.
It gets there sometimes. It's, you know, the Athletic. with our blank canvas there. I mean, every sort of nugget of information was valuable in terms of the book. And I think I originally wrote it to something like 125,000 words, which was too much. So that tells me, you know, somebody said, I think it was I don't want to betray myself as a precious author who obsesses about what people write in reviews on Amazon. But I was reading the reviews on Amazon when somebody said, you know, somebody said, oh, it could have been 100 pages fewer or something like that. Or, you know, and I thought to myself, well, it could. It could also have been 100 pages more, and the version that I was happiest with initially was would probably have been 500 pages, which is too long, really, because it's a big, thick hardback book. It is 400 odd pages, and the fact that I can't really remember much of what I missed out tells you that it wasn't the end of the world to lose those pages. But it was stuff about, you know, him going on holiday, you know, after his GCSEs and sort of celebrating the night Ireland beat Romania in the World Cup, and it was, you know, that kind of thing. You know, there was a lot more that I had that I would have loved to put in a book, but I think you've got to realise that it's there's a limit to it. But I think also, if his 4 years as a professional footballer had to be covered in such detail that they kind of were that middle chunk of the book, I think you couldn't just sort of skirt over the final periods of his life in a really kind of slapdash fashion. I think all, you know, the more detail from that I could get from that time, the better. Even though it was a fairly quiet life at times, you know, the idea of him just having a job for a few months in a, what was it, like a home bakery, you know, just tracking down that person who employed him there, tracking down a person that sort of employed him as a panel beater in Galway. You know, that was like a, you know, probably a 500 word chunk. But I think that kind of thing, when you're trying to tell the story of somebody's life in detail, I think that kind of thing was relevant. And then of course there's his songs and his poems, which I think you can probably glean more about his life in Preston and Galway from those in some ways. So that was, yeah, I didn't want it to be, say, 10 chapters about his time at Manchester United and then a couple of chapters on the end. I wanted to tell the whole story, and you know, it's a fascinating one in many ways, because he lived a completely different life after football, you know, totally different life.
I think that's a brave decision to focus on the post-football life, but you know, the strength of his character allows you to drive that narrative. And I remember reading the book as soon as it first came out, and I said to my business partner Neil, I was like, this is going to be big. This should win the William Hill. That's my take on it as a third party. But what did you think? Because you'd have been so immersed in this world. What reaction were you expecting, and what reaction did you get?
I felt like the story was so strong, and I knew I knew I hadn't fudged it in terms of the research, and you know, I'd taken my time. I hadn't rushed the story out. I'd you know, taken probably a bit too much time for the publisher's liking, but you know, I felt like I'd done a good job on it. So it's not easy to say that, but I felt like I'd tried to do the story justice, and I felt like the story was strong. So I hoped and thought that it would go really well, and you know, the feedback from the publisher Quercus was really good. The feedback from David Luxton, who was my agent, that went really well, and they were the only two people that had read it. And then a couple of extracts went in the Times on, I think, the Saturday before it came out, and that they were very, very well received as well. So I was thinking, hopefully it goes down well. But it was, I mean, look, the reception, you know, I've no idea how many books it sold. You know, it's not a life changing amount. That's for sure. But it's certainly every week somebody will tweet me and say, and perhaps more so in the summer months where people have taken a book on holiday with them and or after Christmas or whatever, and they'll say something very nice about the book. I've considering, you know, as a football journalist, when you're writing about a lot of my, what I do as a football journalist is columns, and that you quite often challenge people's opinion, and you quite often say things as a columnist that people don't really like, and so a lot of the feedback on Twitter is very, very negative from the public. And in the case of the book, the feedback has been sort of relentlessly positive, and you know, the reviews on Amazon, as I said, have been really, really good. And that's it's very gratifying. But I think what matters more in terms of the feedback is that his family really, really, really liked it. And because it was, you know, that they said at one stage to me during the process, will we be able to have a look at it before it's published? And I said, look, I wouldn't really be comfortable with that because, you know, I've got to tell the story properly. You know, I don't want to kind of finish writing something and then it comes back with, you know, oh, we don't, you know, I'd love to you to be able to do a fact check, but I feel like I've checked all the facts myself. I didn't want them to see it, but I really, really wanted them to, when the finished article was sent to them, I wanted them to love it and be proud of it. And it was a bit kind of warts and all. There's, you know, there's stuff about, you know, dark periods and stuff about, you know, drinking and the stuff about his death is so hard for them to read. And it's so, you know, I think his mother has read it all now, but I think she wanted to leave those parts out when she first read it. And I can totally understand that, but the fact that the family enjoyed the book and liked it, and that it's possibly, you know, it's touched their lives in a way that it's changed the way people in Strabane and beyond talk about Adrian, and it's made the people of Strabane really proud of him. And I think Jimmy told me at one point that he got a letter just addressed to Adrian Doherty's family, Strabane, which, I mean, you know, there must be 10 Adrian Doherty's in Strabane, so that probably tells you how much the story had resonated with people. So I think that kind of feedback matters more to me. But yeah, the feedback has been really good, and I don't like to think of it as my book. I think of it as Adrian's story, and as I think I've said many, many times, I just, you know, because he was such a talented guy, talented writer, I really, really wish that he'd been able to write this book, because it would have been incredible. And as long as he let me interview him around the launch time, I think that would have been the best of all worlds.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful that his memory is enshrined in this book. And this is something I emailed you about yesterday. As I was reading through the football sections, I just desperately craved some footage of him. And there's little bits and pieces when he's probably, looks like he's maybe like a young teenager in an Irish TV report. Do you hope one of these days that someone will dig something out of a vault where you see this guy, age 16 or 17, playing for a Man United coach team and just tearing people apart? It'd be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've got, I know a couple of people who played in various tournaments that he was involved in, and they feel that there is some video footage somewhere. I think it was, you know, there was a tournament in Italy when he the Grossi Marrera tournament when he first went there, and I don't think he had a great tournament. I think that was when he was struggling with homesickness, so I don't want that to be the defining clip either. But it was, I'm told that Manchester United do have a lot of this video footage of you know, those reserve team games and youth team games that's never been transferred onto, you know, whatever format it needs to be on, that is in a vault somewhere, and that at some point they will, not necessarily to do anything on Adrian, but just at some point that they will look in that vault and they might unearth something. And I really hope they do, because I mean, look, it's probably got to the stage now where, you know, his legend has assumed the such proportions that people might go, oh god, well, how can it possibly live up to that? But you know, I'm told that if I do see footage, it will be the balance, the bravery, the speed, the dribbling. Well, you know, you're not just sort of looking at, oh, that's a good goal. You're looking at those things I mentioned, the qualities, the physical and technical qualities that he had, and that bravery and the way that he would perform. And yeah, it would be lovely if that sort of footage emerged at some point. And I think if anybody wants to sort of say, well, okay, was he really that good? I think you just have to look at the testimonies from those who have spoken to him, which include Sir Alex Ferguson, who I thought had an axe to grind with the family, but he makes no attempt to conceal how good a talent Adrian was, and also what Ferguson and others such as Paddy Crerand and the coaching staff said about Adrian at the time, you know, back in 1989, 1991, that he was sort of off the scale as a 16, 17 year old, and we'll never know whether injury free he would have had the kind of breakthrough that we like to believe he would have had. But yeah, I think from everything I'm told about his talent and his on-pitch mentality, he would have done. And it's that off-pitch mentality and off-pitch personality which raises a question mark about what his longer-term prospects would have been. But to me, that just makes his character and the story even more appealing.
Well, we live in hope of some on-pitch footage one of these days. In the meantime, there is some off-pitch footage of Adrian singing All Along the Watchtower from Strabane back in the day. In the meantime, we've got this fantastic book to read. So, Ollie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for listening to Between the Lines. Forever Young is available everywhere now. Ollie is on Twitter at OliverK. And if you enjoy Ollie's writing, then he is also featured in our latest book, At the End of the Storm, Stories from Liverpool's Historic Title Triumph. Finally, here's a teenage Adrian Doherty singing All Along the Watchtower to play us out.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.